Introduce our main speaker, Joanne from Henderson, Nevada.
Hey, I'm Joanne. I'm an alcoholic. If anybody is here because they wanted to hear someone named Frank, he's not showing up. I know because I got the call yesterday, so I'm sort of like, you know, a second wife, but I'm used to that. Are you sure you all drank? You look so clean and shiny and good-looking and well-dressed and shoes on and stuff by the most part. Great. My sobriety date is August 23rd, 1973. And I know that's hard to believe from such a young-looking woman, but nevertheless, I was 36 years old when I got sober, when God gave me a chance, another chance at living. And I'm sitting next to a young man named Matt who has 2 weeks, I think. And I'd love to be here next year when you're celebrating a first-year birthday. So glad you're here, and all the other newcomers. Alcoholics Anonymous works. It works good. And it has never worked on my time. I'm distracted by this. I'm kind of getting some feedback here. But I lived with a lot of teenagers, so in a way I'm used to that, I guess. My husband, Chuck, and I drank together. I've been married twice, both times to a man named Chuck. And so this fellow that introduced me, I guess maybe he should watch out. I don't know, he's kind of cute. But the one I'm married to is probably the only one in here wearing a suit, as far as I can tell. Is that right? I heard Clancy say one time that if you're not looking better than your mark, you know, when you're trying to sell something, you're in trouble. And so I've tried to kind of clean up and look as good as I can in the almost 34 years that I've been coming to you. And you know, when I was new, I looked a lot younger, a lot thinner. It was easier. It takes most of an afternoon now to get out there. My husband, Chuck, is a scientist and a certified genius. I've also been certified, but that was from the Nut House, so that's a whole nother story. But Chuck had a mentor and a man that he admired, and a man that he has emulated. And this guy's name is Richard Feynman. He won a Nobel Prize. I don't know how many of you in here have ever heard of him. If it wasn't for my husband, that would not be the kind of stuff, you know, I'd be looking at either. But we have all the books that Feynman had written and some tapes and so forth. I don't know why this popped into my head tonight, but I was very struck by something that Feynman had said as he was growing up. I guess he was a pretty young kid. He was growing up in New York. And he was walking with his dad in a park, and he asked the name of various things. What's that bird called? What's that flower called? What's that called? And his father, who was not an educated man or a genius, as Feynman was, said, it doesn't matter what the name is, just watch what they do. And I have found that analogy so perfect for Alcoholics Anonymous. I really watch what you guys do. I have since the beginning. And I've learned so much. When you have shared in discussion meetings, I've learned how you put things together, how you're able to raise children, how you're able to cope with death, and how you're able to cope with boredom. Anybody besides me, my husband says he's never been bored. I can tell you hardly a day goes by that I don't get bored. If I got to do something more than 3 times, I get bored. And as a result, you know, I'm what I think is described in the big book as restless, irritable, and discontent. So when I say, I've got an idea, Chuck runs for the hills. It's like, oh, God, she's going to want to move or get a job or bring in a foster child or something. And when you hear my story, you'll understand why this guy gets scared. We got sober at the same time. I have about 3 days more than he has. So if you'd care to meet both of us at any time, I think you can tell that difference in the sobriety right away. Well, a little bit about my beginning, which obviously was 70 years ago. I was born in Portland, Oregon. I'm an only child, if you're still an only child at my age, but no siblings. And my parents were married over 6 years before I was born. And they were very eager to have a baby. And my mother told me I was darling and adorable and smart from as long as I can remember. And I believed her. I don't have any horror stories of childhood except the ones that occurred in my head. I've always felt kind of guilty about that. Like, you know, I've heard so many heartrending stories, and I'm so glad that you found the drink to get you through them. Honest, I mean that. Sexual abuse and poverty and homelessness and stuff like that. I didn't have any of those things. Certainly we were not rich people by any manner of means. But when you're an only child, you get all there is, you know. And if you think you're adorable to begin with, until your peers begin to tell you differently, of course, that kind of sets in, you know. So I really didn't have, I don't have a complaint in the world. I can tell you about some of the mean stuff that kids at school did, but no more mean than they were to other people. But here's the bottom line. I'm a pig. I'm a pig, and that's the only thing that I've been able to come up with. I think I had my first drink probably when I was 13, 14 years old. My father was an alcoholic, and I really don't want to forget to tell you how he died. But it didn't seem to be a major issue in our life. I know that, you know, undoubtedly denial plays a big part there, but he was a very quiet drunk. He just sat there on the end of the couch and got drunk. And then my mother would say, "Go to bed, you son of a bitch." And he would get up and go to bed, and then there'd be 2 or 3 days when he didn't drink, and then it would start again. But it was okay. There was no yelling, screaming, anything like that. So, before I forget, because I mentioned this the last time I spoke, and then after the meeting, somebody asked me, "What did happen to your dad? How did he die?" And I forgot to tell you, just in case you're thinking about going out there and trying it again. He died the alcoholic death, and that was in February of 1973. And, you know, one of the first things I heard in AA is that we come in here on the bones of the alcoholic who doesn't make it. Didn't make a lot of sense to me, and it was a long time before I realized that a lot of the feelings I had must have been very familiar to my father. At any rate, my mother called me and said, Chuck and I were living in San Clemente at that time, my folks were still in Portland. My mother said my dad was dying. And so I got in the plane and, you know, the crisis and the drama and all that shit. And if it isn't there, then I can get that going, you know, and tell somebody in the market, you know, about my father's dying. I've got to get out of town. Anyway, I'm superficial, and that's the long and short of that. But so I get there, and he's had a temporary little kind of rejuvenation through some medical treatment. My mother takes him home, and I come back on the plane to San Clemente. And later my mother told me this story. By the time he was taken to the hospital, he had ignored those signs of cancer, those symptoms of cancer, and he had cancer in his mouth. Ultimately, that went to probably throughout his body. And he had to be fed through a tube in his stomach, and he had to urinate through another tube, and he defecated through another tube, and he couldn't talk. And my mother said her last communication with him, he wrote on a note paper, put vodka in my mouth and pour vodka into the tube in my stomach. That's the alcoholic death. That's a hell of a way to go. It didn't stop me from drinking, by the way. I drank, you know, for several more months. That's my father's story. It's not my story. So I'm in high school. I'm starting to drink a little bit. And it gives me the confidence that I didn't think I needed, but gee, when I found it, it made everything better for me. And I felt smarter and livelier and cuter and all the stuff that all of us, I hope, at least you got a few good deals out of those early years of drinking. And I did. And, you know, because I felt a little better, it was the old story. I drank more. And I still am in touch with several women, I was going to say girls, pardon me, girls from high school. And we get together every once in a while. And before we moved here to Henderson 7 years ago, I'd had a group of us, made arrangements for us to have a weekend together. And, you know, they just bombarded me with all these memories of high school. And I was really quite surprised. They thought of me as quite a different person than I did. I think that dependence on alcohol was probably already kicking in. I think I was then feeling less than when I didn't drink. And there is no way that if you had that that jolt, you know, that you would be willing to leave it. One more thing that I want to add before I get past that is that my mother's half Indian. And so I think there may be a kind of predisposition. I know that my mother was the eighth in a family of 16 children. And after I'd been sober maybe 10 or 15 years, I was probably restless again. I began naming all of the people in my mother's family that I knew had died drunk. And it was over half of them. And those are just the ones where they wrote down alcoholism. Like with my dad, they wrote down cancer. You know, there's so many things on a death certificate because we ignore those signs of good health and even the very lowest amount of maintenance, at any rate. And so there I am, 18, 20 years old, going to college, which makes it sound a lot fancier than it was. I was living in an apartment with a couple of other girls and drinking almost every night and taking a few classes. And I had a boyfriend from high school and I got knocked up. What can I say? So we set the wedding date for December 28th, 1956. And about 3 days before that wedding, I miscarried. And I thought, now what? It was too hard to figure out. So I just thought, oh, what the hell, let's get married. And so we did. You know, the wedding was sort of set up and everything. And basically that Chuck number one and I should not have even lived on the same planet, much less in the same house. All of that notwithstanding. And my being kind of a sloppy person, I ended up pregnant 4 times in that 8-year marriage. And I have 4 great kids, although I think all my kids are older than almost everybody here, but nevertheless, they're still mine. And then by about 5 years into that marriage, I'm drinking daily, and I'm trying to hide it. And it was a really awful time because that husband at that time did not drink. If he did, he had, at that time we had this beer that was real little, like smaller than this. And we'd get like a 6-pack of that and it was supposed to last a week. Hello. And he would say things like, what happens to the first? He was very cheap. By the way, he is now a multimillionaire. But he would say, what happens to all the bread around here? Like, you know, we got 4 kids. And then the second question would be, what happens to the beer? God, are you drinking? He didn't know how many times I was going to and from the store, you know, to replace what I thought he might notice was gone. And After I'd been married about 8.5 years, this woman that I had known in high school called and said that she and her husband, whom I had met once several years before, that they were coming to Portland with their three children. I thought she was coming to stay with her grandmother. It turned out the day before they got there, they were planning to stay with us. And I had just gotten out of the hospital from an overdose, although at that time I think they called that a nervous breakdown. So anyway, a couple of days out of the hospital, nut house ward, basically. So this guy and his wife and his three kids come in, and they're going to stay in our house for 2 weeks. And that night, the guy and I started drinking, and then the next morning, the guy and I left together. And that's this husband. That guy always liked a good time. And so then it's Nellie Bar the Gape, because I had found a drinking partner and a man who was crazy about me, and he didn't complain. He didn't talk about going to the United Evangelical Brethren Church, which is what my first husband wanted to do, and stuff like that. And so and besides that, I just fell for him. And that isn't saying a hell of a lot for my moral fiber, because he and I got in the car and we left seven children standing in the yard crying, "Mommy, don't go, don't go. Daddy, don't go." And if you want to think about amends, you know, they're still going on almost 34 years later, the amends that I have to make to my family and others. And so off we go from whenever that was, 65, I guess, was when we left. And it wasn't until 1973 that God gave me a chance for a new life, a life based on these 12 steps and a program that I didn't understand and a bunch of lies that I told. And so that's mainly the part that I'd like to talk about. I'm always suspicious and nervous when speakers say, "I really want to concentrate on my recovery." You know damn well they're going to talk for the whole hour about their drinking. And maybe that's what they need to do, and somebody here is going to hear that. Chuck and I, just to clear the records, we fought like maniacs. He beat me up. I beat him up. He cleaned up my vomit, and I don't remember cleaning his up, but it was a horrible, horrible time. And one by one, these seven kids came back into our lives. I mean, like, in our house lives, not just hello for the weekend. So by 1973, we had all seven of these kids in our house, and they're only 5 years apart in age, all seven of them. And it was definitely not the Brady Bunch. That's like the first thing to remember, because the oldest girl, I'm going to refer to everybody as our kids because we did raise them all, and I'm not going to separate, you know, whose was whose. Our oldest daughter, Karen, she turned 50 last month, and her husband died in a freak accident a year ago, and we were back in San Antonio for the funeral, and I can't, and she's, all these kids turned out well, by the way, which had nothing to do with us. And all the people from her church, there were over 3,000 people at this son-in-law's funeral. And I swear, half of those women came up to me and said, "Oh, you're Mrs. Brady. We've heard about you." And it was like, what fantasy has she woven in her mind about this family? At any rate, got sober because there is a loving God who gave me a second chance at life and an opportunity to maybe pay back just a little bit about what you've given me. And so begins the odyssey of the recovery in the Bodine household. I won't tell Chuck's story. His is probably a lot more interesting than mine, because by then we had moved to Laguna to get a house big enough. And at that time, you could get a house, you know, in Laguna, $42,000 for a five-bedroom house. You could not buy a bathroom now in Laguna for that. But it's nice to kind of throw that around, because then people think we're rich. You know, oh, yes, we used to live in Laguna. We raised our children there. Well, we did that when things were a lot different. At any rate, some of the experiences that I had, and the most important part of my life has been the last almost 34 years. And it all started here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have heard people say this. I heard the laughter from outside, and I just think that sounds so phony, but I got to tell you, that is exactly my experience. We went to, I think, Chuck and I went together for the first probably 6 months of sobriety. We went to the same meetings, and we approached, this was a school library, and we approached that library along a pathway from the parking lot, and I swear on the heads of my grandchildren, that laughter was like silver bells. I know that sounds so phony, but that's just what it sounded like to me. And by this time in our mutual lives, we had no one except each other. And we were pretty damn poor company for each other. And so we approached, and it seemed to me like everybody in that room knew each other. Oh, hello, how are you? Da, da, da. And where are we going for dinner tonight? And where are we going for ice cream tomorrow? And I'll meet you for lunch on Tuesday. And I thought, the hell, did these people know each other? And they all, you know, came in here at one time. I didn't know that some of these people were almost as new as me. And the woman whose laughter I could really identify became my first sponsor. And at that time, I looked at her and I thought, oh, she is so beautiful. She had blonde hair pulled up like this, big top knot, and what I thought were warm, sparkling eyes that turned out to be very red and evil and demanding. All these women change. At least I know that about the women. They change when they become your sponsor. And I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said what I hope I have been able to say most of the time. She opened her arms real wide and she said, oh, welcome to my life, Joanne. And that still just gives me a thrill. She was very dramatic. She was actually, I can tell you her name now. There probably isn't anybody in here old enough to even know, but she was the only girl singer with the Glenn Miller Band. She was Betty Hutton's sister, and her name was Marion Hutton, but when I knew her, it was Marion Schoen. And so she had these dramatic, grand gestures, and God, I just loved her. And she was my sponsor until she died after I was sober about 11 years, I think. And I've only had three sponsors in my sobriety. And because the first two passed away, the third one was not real eager to take me on, you know, to have a great track record. Sponsorship is so vital to my recovery. And I'll probably jump around here a little bit because I want to tell you the things that have been so important to me. First, I want to talk about the traditions briefly. When I was new, and for a long time, when the traditions were read is when I would start whispering to whoever was sitting next to me, did you know so-and-so? And now I want to tell you, I consider them sacred. And they are sacred because without them, I would not be here tonight, and most of you wouldn't. And so I'm what's called a hard ass, you know. Somebody starts talking about something unrelated to sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in an AA meeting. I got to say something. And as a result, you know, there's people who don't like me. And, you know, when when I was about, maybe 3 or 4 years sober, I was asked to read the traditions at a big meeting. Anybody that's ever been to Laguna knows that's the meeting that Chuck Chamberlain started, and it's at the Women's Club on Tuesday night. And I was asked to read the traditions, and I'm not kidding you, I read the tradition and said, popularity before principles. And people were laughing and snickering, and I didn't know what I had said until I sat down and this woman said, "You said popularity before principles." That's not the way the tradition goes, by the way. At any rate, so for somebody who really values popularity and being everybody's darling, it was a real stretch for me to put my money where my mouth was. And as a result, there's a number of women that I sponsor today, and we just completed 1 year of a study of the traditions, and now they are all hard-ass tradition thumpers. So we're kind of spreading out there, and I value that so much, and I appreciate so much the people who carried that banner to me before I knew what the hell a tradition was. And then a couple of things that I don't want to forget. I'm sorry, I've shared this story before, and so bear with me. I see a few women that I sponsor here tonight. Thank you so much for coming. I love you for that. When Chuck and I were maybe in that first year or second year of sobriety, and we're driving up the driveway and to our home after a meeting, and the deal was we didn't have garage door opener. Probably the rich people did. We didn't have them. So I would get out of the car, raise the garage door. He would drive in, and then I would lower the garage door, and then I'd walk in the front door. Well, just as I'm ready to get out of the door to open that garage door, Chuck said, "You know, you're dropping that garage door down kind of hard," and that's all she wrote, baby. "I am ready to call a divorce lawyer on less than that. Are you telling me that I cannot close a garage door? My God." And, I mean, I'm not kidding you when I say one of us had packed up and left on a pretty regular basis on things so much less important than the garage door. And I got out of that car, and God shut my mouth. I did not say anything to him. I thought it, and I still think it. You know? So if you've been sober a while and those thoughts go through and those feelings go through and you just feel that rage build, you don't have to act on it. That's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, because almost 34 years later, and I get a resentment if somebody walks by me and they say hi to the person next to me and doesn't say hi to me, you know? So you can imagine what this thing about the garage door and the springs and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't say anything. For that to stay in my memory all these years as a spiritual experience, and for me to name it as a spiritual experience, is a miracle. That is a miracle. And so that was one tiny little incident. And there were so many involving our children. Most of my learning experiences have been with my husband and later with my children. And now with my children as adults, I think our youngest two children are 43, and so they still come. You know, it's not like the learning's over. If you want to stay sober, and if you want to get old, then what you have to do is be flexible, and you have to be always on alert for these opportunities for spiritual growth. But in fact, that's the truth. That is the truth, because otherwise you get to just be ornery and cold and hard. And I see those people in AA meetings. people not anywhere near as old as me chronologically, but, you know, they've got some sobriety, and they don't want anything to change, and they've got their chair in the meeting, and, you know, I don't want to be there. So, at any rate, we had this odyssey for the first 9 or 10 years of sobriety, and Chuck had risen high in the company that he worked for and that we had part ownership, and for a couple of pretty poor people, you know, to begin with, we were living high on the hog. I mean, shoot, we were going to, I don't remember where we went, England and Scotland and Russia and, you know, pretty fancy schmancy places for a girl who grew up without a hot water heater. I never had a hot water heater till I got married. I mean, we had a wood stove. We were kind of rural Oregon, but anyway. And we decided to give up this good life in Laguna. And both of us had been raised in Oregon, and we moved back there after about 10 years, I think, of sobriety. And we moved to a small town on the Oregon coast. By then, the last of our children was in college. And again, that sounds a little pretentious. I would like to say she was at Yale on a scholarship. No. She was going to a community college because she could still be a cheerleader. And, you know, why shouldn't she? I think it was about her third year in a 2-year college. She is real smart, but she just wanted to keep going because she liked the pom-poms. So we felt like, you know, we could easily move back and go to a place that we both loved very much. And we lived on the Oregon coast for 18 years. And that was the beginning of some real maturity for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I came from what I believe was like the Bethlehem of Christianity, which, you know, I thought Laguna was with regards to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're moving to hell. It was beautiful. Anybody been to the Oregon coast, you know how beautiful it is, but beautiful lasts only so long if you're an alcoholic and you don't get that wonderful fulfillment that we get in our program. And at 9 or 10 years, I think we had the most sobriety of anybody in pretty much in the county. And we both had to grow up. And I had to grow up big time because I was used to the big girls in Alcoholics Anonymous, the ones who would call on stuff going on in meetings that was a violation of a tradition, on making announcements that were not Alcoholics Anonymous, in bringing in literature that was not conference approved. You know, they said that stuff. And now I'm the one that has to say that stuff. And here's the deal. Nobody backed me up. I thought they'd say, oh, well done, Joanne. Hell no. Get out of here. I mean, they didn't like it. And it was scary for me. So, big deal. Whine, whine. I can tell you that I had enough sobriety that I was able to go forward because as much as I love my husband, who is the dearest person in my life, and our two cats and the dogs and our children and the 23 grandchildren, I love Alcoholics Anonymous more. And that's the bottom line. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous more than I love anything or anybody. It allows me to participate in the lives of these other people and institutions that I care about. I'm political, you know. I don't bring that into AA meetings, but I'll catch outside the door. I'm just reiterating the fact that because of the love of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to stand up and be counted and have people not like me. And that probably doesn't sound like a big deal for somebody who only woke up in her own vomit and wet her pants and lied all the time and cheated and stole. But it was a big deal for me. And I know I'm getting close to the time and I'm watching it. Briefly, I want to tell you that I have made amends that have ripped my heart out. I have been so embarrassed that first series of amends I thought was going to be the worst. Oh, no, they're not the worst. I'll tell you what, the really bad amends are when you're like 33 years sober and have to make amends. Friends came back from Hawaii, and they brought me, I think maybe these earrings, I don't remember. And they brought Chuck some candy, I forget that kind of candy, macadamia nuts that are covered in chocolate. And then three little tins of it. One was covered in chocolate, and one tin that was covered in vanilla, and then one that was just sugared. And he didn't get into them right away. And I thought, oh, well. And then I thought, he might notice how much is gone. I probably should just finish that tin, and he probably won't remember that there were three tins. And then I got into the second tin and did the same thing, and then I got into the third tin and did the same thing, and I had diarrhea real bad and stuff like that. But who would leave them? I mean, come on, macadamia nuts covered in chocolate. And so, oh, I was so embarrassed to tell him again. His wife, the pig, had struck and had eaten all the macadamia nuts. And he said, oh, that's all right. I didn't need the calories. Yeah, like I did. I've weighed more than him, I think, for about the last 10 or 15 years. I've had to make amends far more serious than that. But it's never been easy, because you know what it is? It's showing my ass. And I don't like that. I don't like people to think that I am less than what I like to think I am. But it's the thing that keeps me humble, and I'm real grateful for that step. And I can say that now, because I think most of the really worst ones are over, like making the amends to the first husband and all the children and his ex-wife and ad infinitum. I've made amends to attorneys. I've worked for attorneys most of my working life and had to make amends to attorneys for stealing from them. That's something you don't ever want to do, is steal from an attorney. I wrote down more hours that I was working, and I had to go in and tell them I'd done that. And I ended up my career the last 15 or 16 years working for the district attorney. I never stole from him, so... That was good. It's almost 25 after. I feel like I haven't covered what I want to tell you about what this program has done for me and what it can do for you. I welcome you new people. I am so glad you're here. I welcome all the old people. I'm so glad you keep coming back. I'm not sorry that Frank didn't get here. I'm just glad to be a part of this fellowship and this meeting. Chuck and I came to the first meeting at it started right after we moved here, and I thought, how wonderful, because many of the speakers are people that we knew, and I like to say they were friends. They don't remember me from Adam's Off Ox, but, you know, they always act real friendly, like they think they remember me. And so I thank you, and I thank Bob. I don't know that he's here now, but, you know, it takes vision to put together something like this, and I'm really grateful for it. And frankly, that's why Chuck has a suit, because when we moved here, all the men were wearing suits, and he said, I'm not going to go there like a geek and not wear a suit. And so he bought two suits. They've been hanging in the closet for 7 years, except when we come to this meeting. So there's two things I'll close with. The foreword to the third edition of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the last two lines say, talks about, you know, how the fellowship has grown and how many people there are. And it says, but in the final analysis, our program is one alcoholic speaking to another. And that's really what has happened for me. It's been one alcoholic speaking to another. And the last thing I'll say is the thing that has touched my heart for so many years. And that's the last line in the story. And it says, in exchange for a bottle and a hangover, I've been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you.